The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Slate XX Gabfest for Thursday, June 30th, the Actually Good News for Women edition. I'm June Thomas, a writer and editor at Slate, and I'm in the New York studios with Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hello, Noreen.
Hi, June. How was Alaska?
Alaska was awesome.
Did you see, what animals did you see?
Walrus, beluga whales, bears. Wow. Moose.
It's birds. Pretty good.
Yeah, it was good. It was really, really good. It was awesome. I am not among the wildlife of Alaska, but here in New York, but in a more pastoral location in the state of Virginia. Slate Supreme Court correspondent Dahlia Lithwick is joining us this week since Hannah is away. This is the last week of the Supreme Court term, so Dahlia, I imagine you are looking right now like Santa Claus looks just 5 minutes after he delivered his last package. Am I accurate in that at all?
Yeah, a little bit of that. Hi, June, and hi, Noreen.
Hello. Thank you for joining us. By the way, before we get started, I just want to mention that if you listeners have not yet heard the most recent edition of Amicus, which is Dahlia's Supreme Court podcast, you really, really need to, because there are two great interviews on it. First, she talks with Sherilyn Ifill of the NCAA Legal Defense Fund, which is a really great interview. But then the last two-thirds is an interview with the retiring Solicitor General Don Verrilli, which is just so fascinating. It's like the greatest legal interview, the most revealing legal interview of our time. So everybody should listen. It's a fantastic episode of an amazing podcast. So thank you for that, Dahlia.
Thank you. You know, I cried at the end. I, like, teared up because it was amazing. It was amazing to talk to him, and I don't often cry on Amicus, but I really did. I got both goosebumps and tears at the same time, just realizing what an historic era he's presided over. So yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it was really good. So our topics this week are Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt and the latest skirmish in the war on abortion rights. That was the decision that the Supreme Court handed down on Monday. We'll also be talking about the HBO documentary Suited, which looks at a custom clothing company in Brooklyn that specializes in making suits for gender nonconforming people. And finally, the New York Times War on Mom Hair. Then in our Slate Plus segment, we'll discuss whether the SATs are sexist. If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can start your free two-week trial by visiting slate.com/XXPlus. All right, so on Monday, which was the final day of the Supreme Court's 2015 term, we got a really important decision on abortion, and amazingly, it wasn't totally terrible. Dahlia, tell us what Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt was all about and what it means for women in Texas and maybe even throughout the United States.
It was more than not terrible. I think we were hoping, dreaming of not terrible, and this was really a huge, huge win for reproductive rights, and a surprising win because this was a case that could have very easily been 4-4, or it could have been 5-3 on very narrow technical grounds. It was just a blowout win, I think, for reproductive rights, and certainly I think it's fair to say this is the biggest reproductive rights case we've had at the Supreme Court since 1992's Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And this was about that big Texas omnibus legislation that was passed famously over Wendy Davis's filibuster in 2013 in Texas. Only two provisions were at issue before the court. One was that any physician who was going to provide an abortion had to get admitting privileges at a hospital 30 miles away from where he or she was. That's really difficult to do because hospitals do not give admitting privileges all that readily. The other provision was that any clinic that performs abortions has to retrofit itself at millions and millions of dollars of costs as an ambulatory surgical center. That means even if all they do is administer pills, the clinic has to be fitted up so that two gurneys could pass in the hallway, so that there's an HVAC system in an operating theater. And basically the idea was that even though we don't regulate liposuction or other surgical procedures, we're going to regulate abortion in ways that are so cumbersome that the number of clinics in Texas that would have served 5.4 million women of reproductive age went from 40 to about 20 after this law was passed, and would have gone down to about 8 if the law had gone into effect. So we are looking at what would have been just the most consequential reduction of clinics and services for women in Texas. And this was upheld at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So really what was on the chopping block was the very notion that it would be okay to have, you know, 7 or 8 functioning clinics in the state of Texas that have the ability, you know, to more or less make sure that many, many women, particularly poor women or women who worked or minority women, had no access functionally to abortion at all.
And, you know, so the court found that these rules put an undue burden on women or on the clinics? Where was this burden that is a sort of a relic of or something that stems from Planned Parenthood v. Casey, right? That whole term about that idea of undue burden comes from that?
That's exactly right. And what's complicated about this is that nobody knew, even though Planned Parenthood versus Casey surprised everyone, I think, by upholding the core holding of Roe, right? In Roe v. Wade, the court said, we're going to create this right to abortion, but, you know, it's going to be determined by which trimester you're in. And later in the third trimester, you know, it becomes harder to regulate, earlier, easier. And Casey scuttled all that. Casey said in an opinion that, and this is important, it was a joint opinion written by David Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, and improbably Anthony Kennedy. They said, no, we're going to keep the idea that there is a right to abortion, but what we're going to say is that the states can regulate, but they can't place an undue burden on a woman's access to abortion. And the question was, well, what does that mean? It's a pretty gauzy term, and what it enabled was states to regulate more and more and more, and we've seen these so-called trap laws, right, targeted regulation of abortion providers, that purport to be regulations of the health of the mother. Oh, we're just, you know, going to institute a 72-hour waiting period. We're just going to have mandatory ultrasounds or these scripts that doctors read from that suggest there's a connection between abortion and breast cancer. All of these regulations that functionally preclude women from getting easy abortions, but they're all styled as like, these are not unduly burdensome, they're just helping the mother's health. And so really, we are at the point now, and we've seen this around the country in the last couple of years, where more and more and more of these regulations that say, you know, oh, you need to have this kind of hallways in your clinic, you need to have this kind of script and warning, all of these regulations were literally, in some cases, shutting down clinics. In other cases, we're making it almost impossible for women to obtain an abortion. And the states were saying, no, these are not undue burdens. And the courts were very confused. And indeed, the Fifth Circuit that looked at these two regulations, we're talking about the ambulatory surgical centers and the admitting privileges, said, this isn't an undue burden. There's not a substantial fraction of women in Texas who are completely unable to get abortion. So this isn't an undue burden. So what the court really did, and this is a long wind-up for this pitch, is just to say, in an opinion that surprised people because Anthony Kennedy joined with the liberals, you know what? It is an undue burden. These two regulations serve no serious purpose in advancing the health interests of the mothers. Their existence makes it harder for clinics to operate. Therefore, for the first time, the court really gives force to the idea, not only that undue burdens are unacceptable, but that it is absolutely the prerogative of the judicial branch to look at the intention of these regulations and to say, if these regulations don't do what they're supposed to do, advance maternal health, they do not pass constitutional muster.
So, Dahlia, what is this going to mean in practical terms out there, state by state, basically? I read one stat that said almost 25% of all the restrictions on the state level that have happened since the passing of Roe have happened in the last 5 years,
wow,
just since sort of the Tea Party came into power in the 2010 election, and it, especially in state legislatures, which is pretty shocking. And even in Texas, a bunch of clinics have already closed. Like, they're not going to immediately be able to reopen, right? Like, it's there's been a lot of damage done, right?
Well, that's true, and it's funny. I talked to Amy Hagstrom Miller yesterday. She's the head of Whole Women's Health, which was the independent clinics that were the named plaintiff in this case. And she was talking about how hard it is to reopen clinics that have closed. You know, in many, many cases, you know, the facilities have been sold. We don't have providers anymore. So this is not like flipping a switch where you just reopen your clinics. But I think as to the other question, it's really important to understand that, and you're quite right, these regulations passed really recently, you know, in state legislatures, where they would say, oh, you know, look, they've enacted a 72-hour waiting period. We'll do that. You know, oh, here they've, you know, changed the regulations for, you know, the script the physician has to read. Okay, we'll change it too. So there was this huge copycat effect where a state would put some law into effect, and then other states would glom on and say, we're going to do that too. And I think the short answer is that because we didn't have a test case at the court for such a long time, I mean, there really hasn't been a case testing these trap laws. I think that states just did it because they could, mm-hmm. and they thought they could. And so really, I think this is a watershed case. We've already seen just this week the court now batting away Wisconsin, Mississippi, you know, other appeals of similar laws saying, no, we're done. We've decided this. And really, I think it's going to have a massive effect on similar laws around the country, because I think that the courts now have a mandate to go back and scrutinize in a way they haven't before whether there's a correlation between these laws and maternal health. And we just have not had court directives saying, hey, it is absolutely right for courts to dig into the intention. And if the state says this is advancing maternal health, but they're singling out abortion and not liposuction and not colonoscopies for these unbelievably burdensome regs, then the courts can say, no, this is not doing what you're saying it's doing. This is not consistent or coherent. And moreover, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg says in this very brief two-page concurrence to Justice Breyer's opinion, she just says, this is crazy. Abortion isn't dangerous. You know, abortion mm-hmm. is not only constitutionally protected right, but any law, she says, that gets in the way of abortion that has no purpose now does not withstand constitutional scrutiny. That's a really high benchmark.
Dahlia, you just mentioned that the decision was written by Justice Stephen Breyer. Do you think it's relevant or interesting, or does it especially significant that the decision was written by a man?
I'm glad you asked that, June, because I think that we do get very, very fixated, and I really do, on the fact that there are three women at the court, that, you know, when Casey was argued, when Roe was argued, we didn't have three women, and we didn't have the ability of women to say, like, what are you talking about, Texas? So it's very exciting to be able to watch Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg just go to town in just a collective beatdown on the state of Texas and their regulations. But I do think it's important that Justice Breyer was as active a questioner at oral argument as they were. And I think it's really important that he wrote the opinion, because Justice Ginsburg always tells the story of how, you know, toward the end of his life, Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote this unbelievably stirring opinion in a case about family medical leave. And she always tells the story about how when her husband read it, he called over to her and was like, Ruthie, did you write this? And she always says, like, no, I didn't write it. It's just that Rehnquist, toward the end of his life, had a daughter who was a single mother. He was constantly caring for his grandkids. He began to really understand the pressures on women who are trying to balance work and family. And he wrote this incredibly eloquent opinion. And for her, that's really emblematic of how, you know, gender, you know, these gender ideas can be contagious. You know, you don't have to be a woman to understand abortion. And she always says, you know, these are our allies, these men who understand that and fight for it. And I think she probably would love the idea that even though Justice Breyer's opinion is really technical and wonky and even dry compared to the soaring rhetoric she would have deployed if she'd written, I think the idea that he wrote it is so important because it takes it out of the realm of being a woman's fight. This is a fight about pretextual laws and health and the role of the judicial branch. And I think it's kind of powerful and beautiful that a boring old white guy writes an opinion that, absent, you know, the soaring language, still does exactly what needed to be done in this case. So I think it's a very sort of empathetic and hopeful view of how we can think about gender in ways that transcend gender.
So, Dahlia, for those of us who are incapable of just celebrating this news, this decision, what should we be worried about next? Like, seriously?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I think you should celebrate this news.
Okay.
I think that, you know, this was, as I said, this is not a close decision in whole women's health. This is a big win, I think, for reproductive freedom. And it, part of the reason I think we can't celebrate is we haven't had a big win since 1992. And so, like, most of us don't even remember what celebrating feels like. But I think, you know, where it's going to move from, this is my best guess, is these trap laws are going to start to fall, right? Because anything that you do that is sort of allegedly helping women's health, but is in fact making it impossible for them to get reproductive care, is going to now be suspect. So I think those will start to fall away. What you're going to start to see is, you know, these fetal heartbeat bills, you know, moving the cutoff period earlier and earlier and earlier into the pregnancy. Those are not trap laws, right? Those are not dressed up as protecting maternal health. Those are claims that the fetus is a person at an earlier and earlier stage. And so I think a lot of the action is going to move to, you know, the kinds of bills that say the minute you can detect a heartbeat, that is a life, and we're going to ban that. But I think in a way, and this is important, it's been really hard for the pro-choice community to fight these maternal health provisions, because everybody is for protecting women's health. These were hard fights to win. I think there's something about the courts stripping away the pretense of, you know, we don't want to regulate clinics out of existence. We just want to help mothers make good choices and be healthy and not have, you know, as Justice Alito was suggesting at oral argument in Hellerstedt, you know, rats running across these clinics that are abortion mills. And I think that once that pretext is stripped away, you know, that abortion doctors are fundamentally awful people and that these reproductive rights cases are about, you know, enriching them at the expense of poor, unsuspecting women, then you can kind of have a real conversation that is much less bound up in the pretense that this is about women's health. So even though I think by every metric, this is not going to go away, and I think it's certainly fair to say this is going to become a cornerstone of what we fight about in the presidential election. There's something about putting aside the idea that the state can just pretend to be solicitous of women while, you know, forcing them to go to, you know, Mexico for dangerous abortion drugs. I think that once that falls away, at least it's a kind of candid conversation, and it's not a conversation around a fiction, and that's what's been very, very challenging.
All right, listeners, if you want to read more about Dahlia's views on the Supreme Court, there's lots of it in Slate, the Breakfast Table, that is an annual gathering of legal writers at the end of a Supreme Court term, is going on right now. And Dahlia continues to write her Supreme Court dispatches and other legal commentary. Okay, now on to our second topic. Suited is a new documentary directed by Jason Benjamin and produced by Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor, among other people, which premiered on HBO on Monday, June 20th. It focuses on Bindle and Keep, a Brooklyn-based custom clothing company that focuses on making suits and other clothing for transgender and gender nonconforming customers. The main characters are the company's principals, Daniel Friedman, a straight cisgender guy who had a custom suit company, and Ray Tutera, a trans guy who suggested to him that they should focus on working with masculine of center customers. Noreen, what did you think of the film?
I was surprisingly moved by it. I have to admit, the description of the movie made me a little skeptical. It sounded kind of advertorial.
Yeah,
it sounded like painfully Brooklyn, which I think I'm allowed to say because I live in Brooklyn. But it was really moving. In parts.
Yeah,
there were parts where it was like maybe a little schmaltzy. I would have made different choices, perhaps, with how long to linger on certain scenes.
Agreed.
But the idea, you know, fashion is something that's easily dismissed, right? That it's just, you know, you're a tool of these big corporations that are telling you how you should look and how you should, in many ways, conform. And then to literally see people working out how they felt in their bodies, what they wanted the world to see in their bodies by measurements, by saying, okay, this is how I want the hips to look. At one point they ask a customer, okay, like, what's your relationship to your breasts in a suit? Which, like, I think people should just be asked in general.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's like a nice question to consider when you're getting dressed in the morning. Yeah, I don't know. Well, what did you guys think?
I, you know, having just confessed that I cried when I interviewed the Solicitor General, it will surprise you not at all that I also, like Noreen, didn't expect to be moved and was very moved by it. I think in part because, for me, there was just such a big-hearted acceptance that pervaded the movie, and whether it was, you know, Ray and Daniel, the designers, just listening compassionately and asking such good questions of their customers, trying to really probe, how can we help you be visible? Or, you know, Derek, whose mother sits next to him and says, you know, well, I may not be okay with this, but, you know, I love him. You just have a sense of, you know, the sort of various places that acceptance happen and how it happens. And so for me, it was just, you know, such a nice sort of embracing way of looking at it that I hadn't thought about before. So I found it very moving, although I think I would agree with Noreen that there were certainly chunks where I was looking at my watch and thinking, yeah, this maybe not so much of the, you know, this or that. But I think just as a lens into, you know, what I feel is a really universal question about how to help people who felt invisible and whole communities that feel invisible make themselves feel like they could be visible, and what really being proud of, you know, who you are would look like if you've never had that feeling. Very, very, very viscerally moving.
Yeah, I agree. I had a lot of the same concerns that you both described. In fact, it took me a really long time to actually watch. Like, I knew it was coming. Then I knew it was there. And then I just kind of, it took me a while to actually hit play. And then I was like, why did I wait? And, you know, I also had those concerns that, like, is this just a big ad for this one company? And it, you know, there's bit of that kind of is.
You come away thinking this is the greatest company in the, you know.
And also there are so many questions that I wanted answers to that weren't provided in the movie, which I actually got some of them from a piece that was in The New Yorker, where, like, well, where are these suits made? Who are these people, one specifically, one woman who's kind of sitting in the background working a sewing machine who never speaks, so we don't know what her name is. We still don't know, actually. And, you know, how much does it cost?
Ironing,
yeah. How much does it cost? Like, there are questions which seem pretty basic. Like, maybe not how much it costs, because that's very specific to, you know, material.
Oh, I was curious the whole time. And it's about $800, right? That's the base level?
That's what it said, which actually seems
low for a bespoke suit, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because I actually have to, this is where I guess I confess that I have gone to a similar company, not actually that one, but I had a consultation with a similar company that was based in San Francisco. It's now out of business, which was doing tours. So they would go to, I don't know what these cities had in common, Seattle, Washington, D.C., New York, maybe Chicago. And you would, basically they, it was like they do with the, you know, for basically the bespoke suits for guys, where the people come from, usually from Hong Kong, I think, and, you know, they set up in a hotel room and then you go and have a fitting. And it actually was kind of a disaster in a certain way. Like, when the clothes came, which was a very long time after I paid for them, they like didn't fit and they were just weird. Because in that particular case, what happened was that the company, which was the people at the company were similarly wonderful and like great talkers and made you feel great. So like the fitting and the experience of going and seeing them was amazing. And very like empowering in a weird way, even though you were spending, or I was spending like quite a large sum of money, and just kind of made you feel good in a way that, you know, shopping for clothes generally doesn't. But they were really great at that part, but they didn't really have the other part sorted. So they were sending
the part about making the clothes.
Yeah, so they were doing the measurements, just as it seems that Daniel and Ray do. And then they were sending them off to Hong Kong, I think, or to certainly somewhere in Asia to be made by, you know, people who do that for a living. But they clearly had no idea. Really, I don't think they'd had any training with the tailors or any time with the tailors, because, like, I got these shirts back that looked like something that the pilgrims might have worn.
Oh,
like, the shirt, the collar is, like, It's just really weird. And, it, you know, the pants don't fit and had no leeway for fix. I have a friend who's a tailor and she's like, yeah, that can't be fixed. But, you know, on the other hand, I didn't really like, I wasn't that mad because, even though it was crazy expensive, because, like, I've put on weight anyway, so they wouldn't have fit. And, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I couldn't have been wearing them anyway. So,
June, would you ever do this again? Like, at a place like Bindle and Keith?
Yeah. Well, actually, the one thing that yes, I would, because I've now seen that actually they can be, like, you can get the suit,
yeah,
you know, and they can make the adjustments. And it, obviously it's much easier if they're in your city, mm-hmm, rather than in the other side of the country,
mm-hmm,
and that they've actually figured out the whole circle of it, not just the customer service. And so even though in some ways my experience was a disaster, like, I'm really not down about it, because the actually, there was something maybe even more important at the time. I could afford to, you know, just essentially throw away that money. And it was such a positive kind of feeling of being with them and working with them that it almost compensated for the actually the clothes can't be worn. Because I also have lots of other clothes. I didn't truly need them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, what was interesting to me, they had a variety of customers whose,
yes,
stories they followed, and they were all sort of at inflection points in their lives,
yes,
if not necessarily on their gender journey.
Right,
like,
right.
You know, there was a 13-year-old kid about to have, they wanted to have a bar mitzvah, not a bat mitzvah.
And then I'm sorry to interrupt you, but like his grandma.
I know.
I mean,
I know.
That was the amazing thing. Like, there was more than the clothes, which was important. Like, it was really about modeling how to love your kids and your family. Like,
mm-hmm,
Derek's mom and dad, both of them, his entire family. And Aiden's grandma, and even his weird dad.
His weird biker dad.
It was a real glimpse of America, right?
Yes.
Like, you've got this, like, fancy Brooklyn hipster place, and then Derek's family was, like, old Yankee stock, it seemed like, and then there was a weird Arizona thing. There was a law student from Georgia,
sort
of all over the country coming in. So that part was just sociologically fascinating.
Yeah.
But they were all were at, you know, there was one person turning 40 and trying to sort of, okay, sort out, I'm 40, I'm an adult, like, what do I look like? How do I dress? How do I present? And actually, that person was maybe the least worked out in terms of how, I don't think she identified as a man. Am
right.
I getting that wrong?
No, she
went into the women's bathroom.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But she'd had top surgery.
Right, right. So.
I mean, which, you know, I guess just not gender nonconforming.
Right, right. But just sort of seeing,
yeah,
where everyone was,
yeah,
whereas,
yeah,
the 13-year-old was extremely sure of,
yeah, yeah,
of,
yeah,
his identity.
Yeah. And then there was, as the critiques, the reviews, I guess, sorry, the reviews have noted, one of the customers, one who just kind of dropped by almost and felt a little unsatisfactory, was in fact Lena Dunham's sister or brother, sibling, Grace. Who, you know, just was like, she wanted a suit to run around in.
Like, okay. I totally forgot about Grace. Like, I literally,
yes,
was just like, who was that? And I can't even call up a face right now. Yeah, that was a really strange, it was like something was on the cutting room floor that would have helped us understand why that, what that was about. But yeah, I that disappeared completely from my memory.
Well, and there was one person who had transitioned from male to female. Everyone else was sort of,
right,
in the other.
Andrea.
Right. And we didn't see her suit, right?
Right,
I wanted,
right,
to see,
yeah,
it at the end, because she had a big case before,
yes,
an appeals court. She's a lawyer. And I sort of wanted to see,
yeah,
that, which,
yeah,
made me wonder,
me,
if
too,
maybe it didn't turn out so well.
Yeah. I know.
Well,
that,
you know, I thought, didn't you think it was so interesting? I mean, I guess this is where, you know, like, I famously once did CNN with a Cheerio in my hair. So I'm not a person to talk about, you know, appearances at all. And it's like a running joke in my family how, you know, I just don't even understand what I'm looking for. So I was interested in the moments where, like Derek, you know, where the pants just don't fit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's just visibly crushed.
Yes.
I mean, he,
yes,
can't pull it together. He's been totally betrayed.
Yeah. And I mean, they were able to fix the things that weren't happy making. So Derek's suit did eventually fit. But you did see, I mean, I absolutely know what you mean, like that visible feeling of, oh.
Well, because everyone has magical thinking around clothes and your body, right? Yes. Like, I think that if I wear the right dress, I'm going to look like Cindy Crawford, right? And so these are people who, more than most people, want their body transformed. And then to see, like, okay, this suit's going to make me look good, but it's not going to completely change the fact that my hips are my hips, you know?
Right, exactly. I know at first I thought we were going to see a whole bunch of skinny people, because it's just a fact that it is much easier to pull off that look, to get compliments, if you don't have hips. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's actually, I have hips, but you can still get suits that, I mean, like, there are things you can do. But it's like, if you're standing staring in front of a mirror, you're not going to get that magical, you know, transformation. And magic dust is not going to. But there were still, we should also note, some times where staring into the mirror did, you know, move people to tears. Mm-hmm. Like Everett, who is this really sweet guy who's just started law school, I think, and was, you know, really being told some horrible things, but also just really putting a lot of pressure, you know, that law firms telling him, we just don't want to deal with the trans thing, you know, being told, you know, that there are certain rules about the way you dress in this profession. And it's just, you know, that knowing that this was going to be a cause of stress and getting a suit, that just made him feel awesome. Mm-hmm. And that just watching his face, I mean, it was a kind of a risk to take such a long take on that. But it was great. Dahlia, I am reminded, I think, learning some time ago from your pieces that the Supreme Court has very strict rules about girl clothes and boy clothes. Is that still true?
It was true for a long time, and it wasn't even just that girls had to wear skirt suits and boys had to wear pantsuits. But, you know, I can remember, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist had a problem with a woman in a brown suit. You know,
oh my God.
No, true.
Oh my God.
You know, there was just an understanding. I mean, the most rigid understanding of, you know, gender and what you wear, and that it was enforced. And, you know, one of the most depressing stories I can remember is when Ruth Bader Ginsburg would argue as this important, you know, iconic feminist ACLU lawyer. The justices, the all-male justices at the time, would take notes on what she was wearing.
Oh,
you know, like,
God.
That's what they noticed. So, yeah, no, I think it's true that, in a way, I mean, as constraining and depressing as that is, it just goes to show that this is what people notice, right? I mean, that, you know, you could actually care that a woman is wearing a brown suit is really interesting. And just one other anecdotal thing, you know, when Elena Kagan was the Solicitor General before she was elevated to the court, you know, the Solicitor General always argues cases in one of those morning coats, the, like, father of the bride, you know, those tails. And first of all, it's crazy, but I remember there was all sorts of talk about, you know, would Justice Kagan put on one of those coats? And of course, she didn't, but it would have been extra awesome. And I am certainly psyched for the day when an SG, a female SG, does it. But there's incredibly constrained gender roles even today at the court.
All right. Well, the movie we've been talking about is Suited. It was on HBO and we'll be replaying there, and you can find it on HBO Go and all their other online viewing options. All right. Our final topic, mom hair. On June 21st, in the pages of the New York Times style section, B. Shapiro declared, "In fashion, there are mom jeans. So, too, there is a counterpart in beauty, mom hair. You've likely seen it at suburban malls. The longer in back, slightly shorter in front bob that should read sleek but is inescapably frumpy." Dahlia, did this piece make you incandescently angry, mildly bothered, or did you just adore it?
Oh my God, I thought it was the most boring piece of journalism I have consumed in years. Like, I just thought, I suppose there's a kernel of an idea here. First of all, I don't even, like, I'm trying to call up what that haircut looks like with the shorter and the bob, and I don't know what that even looks like. But it was just, you know, it's of a piece with the sort of, I think, the New York Times general thesis of how to talk to women, which is make them feel terrible about themselves, and then they will forward it virally. And so, like, it's just of a piece with, I think, a theme of New York Times gender reporting, which is, like, how crap can we make you feel about yourself today? Go! And so I just, you know, I suppose I should have been incandescently angry because it was just so dopey, but I couldn't even, like, move myself to anger because I was just like, oh, no, you New York Times, you shall not make me feel bad about myself again today. And I just happily put it aside.
Well, I was offended as a reader of the style section. I love when they troll, but they usually do it in such creative, inventive ways. Like, they're just making up things. Like, they make up, like, trends about beards and, you know.
Monocles,
women dyeing their armpit hair. Like, that stuff's fun. This was just lazy.
Yeah.
Like, this is a cliche that's so old. It's not funny. It was just dripping with disdain, like suburban malls and, like, it was mean and lazy, and I think better of the style section than this. Like, that usually it's high level, sort of.
It's much more originality.
It's original trolling. It's artistic. This was just, like, slapped together, no good. It just,
disappointing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and also, as you say, not original. I mean, just in May, I believe it was, that Saturday Night Live had a sketch about mom hair when Brie Larson was the guest host on the show. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
The cut?
Yes, the cut.
You know, the haircut that all moms have. That's a soft waterfall in the front, but knives in the back. The one that looks like you're going to a formal event, but on the way you were struck by lightning.
The scared dinosaur from Jurassic Park.
I don't think that look is for me.
That's what we all thought. But then one day something will break inside of you and you'll know it's time to get the cut.
So I was not offended by that. I thought that was pretty funny in parts. And later on, it goes on to sort of its real target isn't necessarily haircuts. It's mom behavior, though, like
pack behavior.
Yeah, the sort of pack behavior, but also just like little thoughtful things that moms do. Actually, like some of them being ridiculous. Like, you know, the joke was that the bathroom is a seashore. You've got all these, you know, like ornamental seashells in there, but the kitchen is a farmyard, and you've got like details that make it look like a farm, which I thought was funny. Like, there, you know, it was recognizably true in parts, but it was also loving. Like, these people were, I would imagine that the writers were sort of drawing on moms that they know and love when they were writing those jokes. And for some reason, it just didn't bug me in the way that this article did.
So can I just note one thing?
Please do.
I was in the makeup chair for one of TV shows this week, and I had brought my son's 13-year-old friend, the daughter of friends of ours, just to see the green room and drink free soda. And it was so great when she was earnestly explaining to the makeup lady that, like, Daya can look really, really good when she tries. And I was totally, like, I hadn't yet read the mom hair piece, and, you know, the makeup woman was, like, slaving to, like, get hair that had been wet in the rain earlier in the day to look like, I don't know, it looked like crazy, you know, I looked like Farrah Fawcett. But it was just so funny to hear this 13-year-old, like, really apologizing for my hair to the makeup lady. I was like, oh, thank God I have no daughters. But it was just such an interesting, you know, thing where I do feel like it does go to this odd thing where, you know, you really are expected to really work at this. And when you're like, I haven't slept in 2 weeks, I read 900 pages of opinions. And then, like, you know, just to have, like, the sweetest girl who was at the court when Hellerstedt came down, because she's a feminist, be like, sometimes she puts on makeup and she looks pretty good.
Well, okay, so now that we've dismissed the premise as sexist, can we consider whether there really are ways that moms are either expected to dress or just end up dressing? So the thing that I've always heard, I have long hair, and whenever I hold a baby, the baby grabs the hair, and the mom will always be like, oh, you've just got to learn to put that up or whatever, or get it cut. And that's what I'd always heard about why women cut their hair short when they have kids, just like sheer practicality. But not everyone does that. My beautiful sister Maura had a baby, 18 months ago, and she has not gotten her hair cut since, I believe. And she looks like a beautiful Lady Godiva. So there are all different ways to do it.
Dahlia, you're the only mother among us. Do adult women and adult women who've given birth or who have children really get shit for taking a low maintenance approach to their grooming?
I think you do. I mean, I think, you know, it's a sort of perfect storm because you have this weight that you gained and you have not slept. And so you look like you like killed a man, like you just look googly crazy eyed. And then to boot, like you're supposed to be, you know, working the flat iron for 2 hours a morning. And like you don't, because that's your sleep time. And so it's a horrible, horrible time. And, you know, I that was when I turned to the Ruth Bader Ginsburg style scrunchie. And I have, you know, 13 years later still wearing it. But I do think that it is, and I guess this is the part of, you know, the piece that did speak to me. I think that it does go to this, like, you do want to feel beautiful. And maybe this goes to, you know, the documentary to Suited, but you do want to feel beautiful. You feel terrible and you've turned into this sexless, you know, boob dripping, you know, monster, and everybody's telling you to work harder, you know, like just be more beautiful. Come on, you know, here's this eyelash curler, you know, work it, and you're tired. And so I'm not quite sure what to make of the people who really are politely advising you to just get it together and be beautiful because you'll feel better, because you're just, you know, at least in the first little while, you're just destroyed. And so I'm not sure. I sort of think, like, in a perfect world, like, you could have some tent that you retire to for 3 years and everybody would, like, you know, be in their pajama bottoms and, like, you know, have just complete no responsibility for their appearance at all. But I do think that there is this tension, you know, certainly in all the magazines you hear about people being back to their pre-baby weight in 40 seconds. So there is a lot of pressure. You know, it's seen as an act of serious self-care to get yourself, you know, beautiful again. But it just comes at a time when you're more vulnerable than you've ever been in your life. And so I feel like that message is really hard to hear.
All right. I think the message that we're hearing here is anyone who's given birth in the last 5 years and who doesn't want to get mad at the New York Times, or especially not sort of self-conscious about themselves, should avoid the piece by Bea Shapiro in the June 21st New York Times.
Strike that name out. Strike that day out. It shall be known.
Throw that newspaper away. All right. Now it's time for recommendations. Noreen, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I have two. The first one is sort of cheating, which is why I have two, because I've recommended this about four times in different ways, but I'm finally on the fourth Elena Ferrante book of the Neapolitan series. And I, like, have been very slow to finish the series, much more slow than a lot of people have been. It's been a couple of years that I've been sort of slowly working my way through it. I think in part because I find them so emotionally overwhelming. Like,
wow.
This one I actually had to put down halfway through. I was reading it at the beach, and it was just like there was so much happening. And I put it down and came back, and I'm finishing it in New York because I just needed a break. But so if you haven't started these books, you should just, like, you should, as a woman, as a human being. I think that it's incumbent on you to do it.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's not as much of a chore as I just made it sound like. And then the second thing I watched a movie. I love screwball comedies. I love particularly comedies of remarriage, as they're called. And I rewatched for the first time in a decade His Girl Friday.
Oh, yes.
Which, if you haven't seen it, just go run, you know, stop the workday right now. It's Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell, and it's a journalism plot, and it's great clothes and dialogue and just the whole nine yards. Just go watch it.
I almost wanted to have children just so I could name one Hildy.
Oh, it's such a good name. It's such a good name.
Yeah. Okay, my recommendation this week is an old book, but one that I read when I was on my way to Alaska, and it's The Lost City of Z, or actually, I guess, The Lost City of Zed, perhaps, by David Gran, a great New Yorker writer. And it's his attempt to retrace the steps of the great explorer Percy Fawcett, his last adventure in Brazil in search of a lost civilization. And Gran, you know, he's a wonderful writer. He's got amazing, it's like the perfect New Yorker piece, that combination of like style and information about something weird and strange that you didn't know existed but are suddenly completely obsessed by and are fascinated by. It's, and also, especially as an indoorsy person myself, as is Gran, I really related to his, you know, like it just even he talks about his going to a sort of outdoor outfitters and just figuring out what even these things are and buying all this stuff and knowing that you would never again use it once your trip is completed. And having just done that very same trip to the outdoorsy outfitters, I know exactly what that's about. So, but it's just a fantastic book, The Lost City of Z by David Graham. Dahlia Lithwick, what do you have to recommend to us?
I'm going to recommend an amazing camp that my, I was going to say a 10-year-old, but he's now 11-year-old did. And this is part of the World Peace Game Foundation, which people should just Google John Hunter and the World Peace Game. John Hunter, and here I'm a little biased, he was a teacher in the public schools in Charlottesville, Virginia for many years. I think he developed this idea of simulating. I mean, this is not Model UN. This is unbelievable, and it's aimed at like fourth, fifth, sixth graders. And it is a game that he developed that literally involves you being in charge of the entire world. And kids are assigned different countries. They're assigned, you know, there's this set of problems that include, you know, environmental crises and banking crises and immigration crises. My 11-year-old son somehow was made CFO of the World Bank. And he was quite happy talking about trillions of dollars that he was dispensing. But it is a week-long camp, and it's part of this World Peace Game Foundation that John has, in addition to his TED Talk, which is just staggering, and a documentary about it, has taken this game all over the world, to countries all over the world, training teachers to use it. And it really is, you know, I think people say that, you know, your kid has this transcendent, life-changing experience, like just over ice cream. But this is just something that absolutely changed my son's life. So I would just say, if you can find a way to finagle your kid into a World Peace Game camp or project or a school that teaches it, or, you know, schools should be looking at getting this program onto their curriculum, I think it changes lives.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now going to have Hildy name her, grow her to 11, and send her to camp. Okay. I'll get on that.
She too can be in charge of the World Bank.
All right, that's it for this week. Thanks to our producer, Anne Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Thanks to our intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. The XX Gabfest show page is slate.com/xx. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabfest. Our email is xxgabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe on iTunes. For Noreen Malone and Dahlia Lithwick, I'm June Thomas. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Hey! Fancy pants. You're a pussy-footin' critter. When you see a gal, you skitter. Hey, you! Fancy pants.